Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. This show is brought to you by Swarbricks, the first law firm in New Zealand to accept Bitcoin for legal services. The team at Swarbricks understand Bitcoin thinking and are knowledgeable about the legal aspects of Bitcoin in New Zealand in areas including estate planning, property, and trusts. Swarbricks offers a 20% discount for services paid in Bitcoin. Find out more at swarbricks.co.nz/Bitcoin. Now, in today's episode, I talk with James Vigiano. We talk about James's project Orange, which hosts a server in the popular multiplayer survival game Rust, where you can trade and learn about Bitcoin, have virtual meetups, and complete missions to earn sats. We also cover James's experience trying to run a Bitcoin exchange in New Zealand and being denied banking services, as well as broader ideas about the future of the New Zealand economy and a realistic take on what CBDCs might actually look like. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you. Otherwise, on to the show.
Hey, there we go.
Welcome.
Hey, good to see you.
See you. How you been?
Good, good. How was Japan?
Yeah, it was good, man. I was over there for a month. Yeah, I can't remember. Have you been to Japan before?
I have, yeah, but only for a short trip.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. Thank you. I really needed it after 3 years.
Yeah, after the lockdowns, right? You have to go out and see the world again.
It was exactly what it needed to be, though. Like, even just from taking the airplane back, like, I don't know, it was almost karmic. But, you know, I was just so thankful and grateful to just be able to go. And I think, like, even the cabin crew and that, they kind of felt it. And I got, like, a free upgrade. And it was just really... really fun, and I don't know, they must have changed the airplanes, but I was able to use the internet. I remember back in the day that you never used to be able to use Wi-Fi, and I was like, man, that's so powerful. And I talked to my friends, I'm like, man, that's been normal in most airlines for like 5-10 years.
Yeah, it's a game changer, right? Especially for a long haul flight, you can still check your internet, check your messages and stuff.
I actually used my Bolt card from 30,000 feet, which I thought was nice. Kind of cool. It's like the Mile High Club.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And you've been traveling a bit recently as well?
Not that much this year. I did a bit last year. Yeah, I still traveled a little bit during COVID, and it was always good to have that feeling of not being trapped in New Zealand. Like, yeah. Once you kind of get out of the plane, you remember the world is still running. You know, things aren't quiet everywhere. But yeah, doing some travel later this year to the US for a conference, and then next year hoping to go to El Salvador again.
What conference are you looking to go to?
The Atlanta Bitcoin Conference.
Okay, that's Georgia, right? So that would be that sort of part of the US is quite a Bitcoin hub at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's pretty cool that with Air New Zealand you can fly direct into Houston, and it seems that Texas, Georgia, and actually another place we're planning on visiting is Bitcoin Park in Memphis.
Yeah.
So that, I think that's where it is.
That's Marty Bent and those guys are out that way, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. So it'd be cool to see what the community's like there.
Yeah, I've been following Bitcoin Park for a while. I think it's a really cool concept of a makerspace. You know, they've got podcasting equipment, you know, spaces to do, you know, events and functions, and I think also maybe some builders are based out of there, just people working on projects.
Yeah, and I think having that permanent spot where people can regularly meet up is quite useful for that community. So it's like touching base with the same people every month or so at a meetup is really helpful.
Yeah, I think that's been the big realization for me over the last year, is seeing how important those in-person meetups are, regular contact with people who are passionate to be working in Bitcoin and on Bitcoin adjacent projects, and that kind of proximity effect of having just people mulling over ideas and kind of being industrious is something quite powerful about that.
Yeah, it's really useful.
Yeah, it's almost a vibe change to the kind of lockdown era, where I think a lot of people were sort of quite atomized and not able to really connect, and so we've kind of had this pendulum swinging back the other way. And I know for myself here in Wellington, I'm regularly meeting. We have sort of a weekly honey badger meetup, and you know, I've got some of the other events going on. But what's where are you at the moment? You're up in Auckland, James?
Yeah, I'm in Auckland at the moment. That's what's been really cool about BitKiwi in New Zealand. Like catching up with you in person and the other guys has been great.
Yeah, what's the scene like up in Auckland though? I mean, as our biggest city, I mean, would you say there's a bit of stuff happening up there? Or
yeah, I think it's being quite a large city, it's all spread out. There's different people doing different things. I'm not a very in-person social type, so for me, it's going to like those special occasion meetups is what I like to do. But there is actually a really cool little space in the heart of downtown Auckland. The Ultra School of Bitcoin. I walked along, saw that, and I was like, such a shock. I was like, oh, wow, someone's doing something with Bitcoin, like branding everywhere, right in the heart of Auckland. Popped in, said hello. And it's just like I think it's just an idea they're trying to grow into something bigger. And so it's cool to see little things like that starting to happen. And there's a couple of restaurants that accept Bitcoin. So it's starting to get traction.
Yeah, I had Hanoz on the show a couple of months ago and spoke about his journey to develop the Altruist School and that space. And it was really quite cool. I believe it is actually the first dedicated Bitcoin space in New Zealand that people can go to.
So. I'll have to go back and listen to that episode. That'd be great.
Yeah. No, it was a couple of months ago now. But no, I'm really excited for what he's doing. But I'm keen to just hear from you, James, a little bit about what you're excited about, what's happening right now, either in your world or more broadly in Bitcoin space.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I'm spending a lot of my time on at the moment is the Orange Project. So we launched a fundraiser on Geyser. And the purpose of that was to get some funds to run. The funds are for a gaming community or a gaming team or clan, a sports team type thing. And we host a server in a game called Rust, which is quite a popular survival game. So what I've been doing every day is helping to really grow that virtual space. Because while it is a game, it is also a social space and it has a whole community around it with like Discord and like there is the meetups that are regularly happening there once a month, like more organized meetups that we try to film and broadcast and help get people's messages out. But there's also every day, it's like a town square. So you just bump into Bitcoiners every day that you chat with and meeting some people from all over the world, which is amazing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's getting me quite excited.
How did you come, and we will get back to your origin story eventually, I hope, but how did you come to be working on that project, like in this Rust game? Like how did Orange come about?
I think it came about through just like wanting to keep on making progress and improving with areas where I was getting traction. So by traction for me was having an impact with orange pilling people, because that's really what I'm trying to do is orange pill people. I'm sure the listeners know what that means, but it's basically helping people to understand and get comfortable with Bitcoin, because that's something I really believe in. And I obviously have a vested interest because I have been using Bitcoin for a while and I love it. So during the bull market years when, you know, things were bubbly and fun, I was jumping onto the games because I used to be a gamer when I was younger and I jumped into Rust. And I just had this experience where a lot of people on there are toxic. They're out there to kill each other. But the objective of the game isn't actually to kill each other. The objective is to survive. And I managed to get quite a bit of traction playing in the local scene, like around Australia, New Zealand community, through my play style, which was to trade with people rather than steal from them. I would offer them a trade. And through trading, I was able to make a lot of progress in the game and build up a little bit of a following of players who wanted to play with me and learn my play style. And what I always did as part of my strategy for survival was I'd set up a shop that I'd call the Orange Mart, and I would put Bitcoin logos all over it. And I would just encourage people that, you know, we can exchange value with each other rather than stealing from each other. And then the progression of that is Rust is quite an open game that allows people to host their own server. And you can modify it in ways to your liking. And that's really what we're trying to do is by hosting our own server, focusing it around Bitcoin, having a Bitcoin community aspect to it is really just an opportunity that I wanted to jump on.
I'm curious with Rust, and I mean, that's a proprietary game engine, right? So you're within their sort of ecosystem, is that right?
Yeah, so it's like, so we're running our own version of the game, like our own server that we're modifying in ways that we can modify however we like without their permission. But they, as the primary developers of the game, so it's been around for 10 years, and every month they actually update it with new content that they're working on. So to continue to have our server visible through the main discovery platform, which is Steam, which is like a social platform for gamers. It's like the Netflix of games. To continue to have our server discoverable there, we have to keep up with their updates. So in that sense, they definitely control the game and are developing it, but we are like private owners of our own island, our own server.
Yeah, no, man, I'm old enough to remember when Steam came out, unfortunately. But I'm curious though, we're talking about Bitcoin here, and I've got a copy of The Road to Serfdom here in my hand, talking about Austrian economics and some of these concepts you're talking about. I really thought that was interesting. You said, you don't need to shoot the other person, you can trade. And I think that's been a theme that a couple of people talked about, things like RuneScape.
I was big into that when I was
Oh, yeah, no.
a
And Diablo, there's kind of different games where you can trade objects in game. With the way you've done it, I mean, is that able to connect back into the Bitcoin ecosystem, in terms of, say, using the Lightning Network? Is there ways to work that into what you've done with Orange?
Oh, it's quite interesting. So there's a couple of ways to do it. What we've done so far, also everything we do is subject to change, and we're trying to make progress every month. So that's the beauty of it, is every month everything gets deleted and we rebuild and start again. But where we're at the moment is players can upload an image onto a sign at their shop, just like how in real life, if you go to El Salvador to a coffee shop, they put a QR code up on the wall, and they just say, "Oh, just send your Bitcoin there, and then we'll give you your coffee." Same thing happens in game. So you can upload any QR code, bring whatever wallet you want to use for trading in the game. So that's one method people are using to transact sats peer to peer, is either through a QR code or just through passing notes to each other with an invoice on it, or even just through having your Lightning address written on the wall so people can see where to send the sats. But there is the way the server is trying to orange pill people is by rewarding them with Bitcoin too. And so we have this, the current main kind of mechanism we're doing for that is by having a rare drop, like a loot reward, in some of the harder missions across the island. And that rare drop, we've just used an item called blood, because there's no other way to get blood in the game. So we can control the distribution of blood through these rare drops. And basically, the theme is go out there, do the hard work, do the hard missions, collect the blood, and then come back to Orange. So part of the mission is to bring it back safely to Orange and not get killed along the way. Bring it back to Orange, trade it in, and we'll buy the blood off you with Bitcoin. So we have an automatic vending machine where you trade in the blood, and then you get a note that has the claim link to claim the sats. So you can use whatever wallet you want to claim the sats.
Yeah, that's cool. A couple of things that come to mind here. Firstly, what you're doing is really this ability to run economic simulations through games. I think there's something really interesting about that. And as I said, come back to the RuneScape example, and maybe, I mean, maybe that was a little bit longer ago, but this idea of objects being monetized, what objects end up becoming the money in game. You've got this blood that kind of acts as a, I guess, a substitute for actual Bitcoin within the game, world, and the parameters of what's possible within the game in terms of existing objects. But you're able to peg it because it is, you're in control of that, and so you're able to create this sort of one-to-one backing of Bitcoin and this rare object. There's something really cool about that, and it's enables, because you're wiping the server out every month and starting again, it enables this kind of rapid iteration of economics and sort of almost simulating a microeconomy. I mean, is that something that you planned originally, or is that just sort of what has happened?
Well, the goal is to grow both an in-game economy and to help Bitcoiners create a real economy. So we've already had people join the server and advertise real-world services, like a graphic designer join the server, and they put up a billboard that said, "I'll design a custom animated graphic for you for 1,000 sats," or something like that. Another player did a little trade with them, got his little graphic. So there's real-world trading happening too. On the point about the blood kind of peg thing, I tell people that no, blood is not Bitcoin. It's just something that for some reason the Orange Mart running the blood bank is happy to buy it off you for Bitcoin. But there's other items in the game that other players are happy to buy off you for Bitcoin too. So if you find like a, let's say I'm someone that, to explain the game a bit, everyone starts off with nothing. And so to make progress, you have a lot of work to put in. But if you don't have much time, like you're working full time and you just want to play in the evening, you might join the server and be like, hey, I want to buy some resources. I want to buy some wood and some stones. I can build a house. I'll pay Bitcoin. Someone might sell you those for Bitcoin. So you don't necessarily have to, the only valuable thing, and they're all digital items, so they're not really valuable, but they all could be worth Bitcoin to someone. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there's nuance there, though. So they're digital items, but they do have value. I mean, just as Bitcoin does. It's just this abstraction that we have, which is, I think, a generational thing. It's something that maybe, digital natives are able to grasp a little bit easier. But these objects do have value, and the value is defined through the market.
Especially when they take a lot of time and work to earn, and if you're saving someone else that time and effort, and they're willing to give you Bitcoin, it's just exchanging time for time.
Yeah, and that's where I think what I was sort of alluding to earlier, that there's this possibility to model these microeconomies and experiment in ways that, in the kind of meat space, we only get one go to do it. It's emergent. You can't go back and control Z and reset things, right? And despite jokes about the Great Reset and the lockdowns, the reality is, the economy, the real world economy, is far too complex to be able to do that. But with a game, in this digital space, you can actually clear the cache and start again. And I'm wondering whether this relates back to your earlier career, which I'd be keen to just talk about that and sort of your introduction to Bitcoin, because I know you were working in sort of finance and that sort of side of things originally. And I imagine there's a lot of modeling, stochastic modeling, these kinds of things related to that. And I'm just wondering whether there's connections with those two. But I guess that and then your introduction to Bitcoin and your origin story, if that's okay, please.
Yeah, we can go down that route. So like for me, the introduction was I felt like a lot of people had the similar introduction that are my age, where I was at university at the right time. Everyone's at the right time, but for me it was right when the Silk Road was the thing. So I personally wasn't using the Silk Road. I just people in the dormitories where I lived, the university dorms, oh, how'd you get that weed? Oh, bought it online. Oh, okay. And then they tell you, but you have to pay with Bitcoin. So the first interaction with it was, oh, okay, so that's like RuneScape Gold or Neopets. It's just some digital token. It's nothing special, so I ignored it. The second interaction would have been in 2013. So yeah, I was studying at university, a law degree and a commerce degree, and within commerce, I was really interested in finance and economics. So I was running, I was a part of, and then helped run an investment club at the university, and someone in the club was really excited because Bitcoin had gone all the way to $100. So my reaction then was, oh, okay, well that's definitely a scam. That's some kind of internet bubble thing, like all the other internet scams that were around at the time. So I ignored it because through my gaming kind of history and internet history as a kid, you get exposed to lots of scams. You get ripped off all the time on the internet, and people have always been selling fake money. There's always been like some kind of digital gold thing that's always just been a company offering some kind of token. So I ignored it when it went to $100, but then later that year it went all the way up to $1,000, and I happened to be doing an internship. It was the New Zealand summer, so it was around Christmas, an internship with New Zealand Sovereign Wealth Fund, the NZ Super Fund. It was a really cool internship because the guy I was working under basically said, you can spend the summer just helping us research alternative asset classes. So to them, that meant looking at things like catastrophe bonds, which is like insurance on when a weather event happens. But the most interesting alternative asset class was this new thing called Bitcoin that had just gone all the way to $1,000. So I spent the whole summer just like reading everything I could about Bitcoin, which back then was different little blogs on the internet, different posts, maybe a bit of Reddit was there, lots of stuff. Because it was a bull market for Bitcoin, the media coverage of it was actually quite positive at the time. You'll notice that in the bull market years, like in 2013, 2017, and 2021, some of the media gets very bullish on it and hypes it up. So it was quite exciting time. And then, I like everyone, I bought high and then had that gut-wrenching experience of, oh, it's fallen 90 or 85%. It's lost all its value. Everyone around me calling me an idiot, saying I've been scammed, saying that Bitcoin's dead. And you do feel like an idiot a little bit because you've just lost 85% of the money you've invested in something. So that was kind of my introduction to Bitcoin. And I think a lot of people have a similar introduction where they get in when it's really exciting and then they have to persevere with it through that bear market. So in those subsequent bear market years, I was still studying at university and doing other finance-related internships and then went on and started a career at an investment bank on the trading floor.
Did you see parallels between those two worlds, this interest in Bitcoin and this, investment bank, trading floor environment? Were you able to connect those two and integrate them together, or were they quite separate for a while?
Yeah, they are very connected, but the response you'll get from talking to people in those industries back then, I don't know what it's like now, but they're very dismissive of it because when you talk about Bitcoin, the key traits that you're highlighting are quite disruptive. And they are the incumbents and the majority of their competitive advantage comes from what's called regulatory capture. It's effectively a cartel. So the way that when you talk to people about it, the individuals you talk to, especially the younger graduates like myself, super interested. What is this new money? But also very dismissive of it, like how I was initially. But when you're on the trading floor and you're sitting there watching the waiting for the central bank to tell you what's going to happen to the money, you start to when you learn more about what the central bank is doing, there's so much parallel to Bitcoin. So the angle that I understood Bitcoin from was the scarcity angle, the fixed, unchangeable monetary policy, because it's the changing monetary policy that is manipulating and moving markets so much and influencing markets so much, and that the banks are monetizing and being subsidized effectively by so much. And then another aspect that interested me about Bitcoin, other than the economic side, which is really related to my work, was the censorship free speech side of it too. And that's I was a little bit naive when I quit my job. I didn't think that the banks in Australia and New Zealand were as aggressive with their anti-competitive behavior as what I'd seen overseas. So when I started up a Bitcoin brokerage, we did dollar cost averaging for Bitcoin in Australia. The pushback from the banks, the treating me like a criminal, the debanking me 10 times, the locking up the funds of the company for 6 months, when we had done everything by the book, we had followed every regulation that they were coming out with, every KYC thing they wanted us to do. But the reality is they are the ones that clip the ticket. And if you're trying to clip the ticket too, well, you're doubling up on something that they want to. They actually want to be the ones clipping the ticket on Bitcoin, but they want to have the regulation in place that makes it so that it's just them that's doing it.
Sorry, there was this Crypto Saver, your business that you started.
Yeah, so it's called Crypto Saver. There was another business at a similar time called My Crypto Saver, which is different. And then there's another business in the UK that had a website, Crypto Saver, but that was like a total scam. So it's a bit confusing. What we did was we only did Bitcoin dollar cost averaging. And that wasn't actually a principled reason because we weren't fully Bitcoin maximalists when we started it. The reason was that starting a business, we wanted to focus on Bitcoin, and we knew that the cheapest way, if you wanted to actually invest in those other cryptos, the cheapest way is to buy Bitcoin and then take that Bitcoin to a crypto exchange. And you can go gamble it there if you want to. You can do whatever you want with your Bitcoin. But it wouldn't have made sense for us to try broker the other ones too. But yeah, Crypto Saver, it lasted about a year and a half before we got to a situation where we would never be able to scale because the only bank account, the only fiat rails we were allowed to have by the system were underneath another company, basically a loophole in the system where would be a subsidiary to someone else, so would never actually be the complete owner and controller of our business. So it didn't really make sense.
Are there some challenges there? Because obviously we have, exchanges, centralized exchanges in New Zealand. However, there has been criticism that they are highly aligned with the banking system here in many cases. And so your crypto saver business has some real challenges getting banked, and yet there's exchanges that are walking around and selling Bitcoin and other...
Each of the banks has their play.
Yeah.
And so in New Zealand, Kiwi Bank has its play. And New Zealand in particular is such a small market that there is actually a logical reason why they don't want too much competition. They just want to help nurture one business. And then the other banks in New Zealand are all Australian owned and all their plays are in Australia. So New Zealand is only really catered to by one major player, really. But in the world of exchanging fiat for Bitcoin, we don't have that much of a mining industry in New Zealand that's generating Bitcoin. So there isn't that much organic supply of Bitcoin for New Zealand dollars. So most of the Bitcoin in the world is being sold for US dollars, and that all happens overseas. So any service we use in New Zealand is really just a middleman helping you get access to overseas liquidity. And that's the bread and butter of banking. That's the financial rails. You have to go through a fiat financial rail to get to US dollars. So it is the banks that gatekeep that.
Absolutely. There's, criticisms have been labelled and their names shall not be spoken, but there's, centralised exchanges that are basically, as you say, just the portals for overseas big international exchange liquidity, and that's it. And yet they're still able to slap that nice premium when you're trying to buy from little old New Zealand.
Yeah. The interesting thing about that is the premium is so they can fund their business, which is fine. You need to fund your business. But when your business is investing that premium and expanding in the direction of making a casino, so basically building out the banking system's product suite of equity token offerings, but now you're adding shitcoin token offerings to it. When all that premium you're paying is going to fund that, and now we're 5 years into the Lightning Network, and you're meant to be a Bitcoin brokerage or Bitcoin service provider, but you don't even help people actually get Lightning Bitcoin and actually use it. I don't like giving those companies a premium because they're not actually investing it into Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, it's a distortion of capital allocation. They've got this kind of moat and then also this kind of capture of narrative. Like these centralized exchanges have a very strong voice in New Zealand, which again is a small country. And so it only takes a few people and they get on the news and they start talking and then they're the ones that are on, the government advisory boards. And it's easier because they've got a name and they've got a company and they've got an address and all of these things. But as a Bitcoiner, it's like, well, I said this actually when I met with one of the guys from the Reserve Bank at an event. It was a bit of a funny coincidence having a chat with him. And he asked me, Cody, who are you affiliated with? And I said, I'm affiliated with myself. I'm a Bitcoiner,
The government's so used to being lobbied by people. And that's the reality, is the reason like government regulation ends up being captured by the industry is because the industry put the effort into lobbying and spending money trying to convince government to change the rules in a direction that favors them. Whereas the individuals, the Bitcoiners, we're so busy just trying to live our life and build things in Bitcoin that we're not trying to actively lobby the government to make rules because we don't need rules to help us. But then the people who are building a business that relies on the rules to protect their moat, they get those rules put in place to protect them.
Yeah. Well, even I think Guy on Espinel was doing a bit of an expose on that in terms of the lobbying in New Zealand is highly unregulated. Like, I think in many countries, there's a lot of sort of legal requirements, requirements for how you, you try and build moats like that. But actually in New Zealand, it's super loose. And I don't really follow fiat news anymore, but it's like, what capability have they got to just kind of walk up there and, do a deal? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I guess, though, at the end of the day, Bitcoin is peer-to-peer. And so, like, bringing it back to Orange, you're probably similar to me. When you were younger and torrenting or, peer-to-peer file sharing came out, we used to pay, $20 or $30 for a CD with 12 songs on it, and now we could get it all for free digitally, immediately, directly into our iPod or whatever. It's crazy that it was because the kids were openly breaking the law, openly willing to do something that was much more convenient, much more efficient, And actually, at the time, wasn't necessarily breaking the law because the laws hadn't caught up yet. But the digital piracy helped revolutionize the whole way that we consume digital content. Now, most people were just happy to pay, for example, Spotify a subscription to have it automatically torrenting every file out there for them, like bringing every file to their phone and making it available to them, streaming it to them. And that industry, the music industry, probably wouldn't have gotten to where it is today if it didn't have the young people willing to just use the tools to their advantage to have a better world. And so with Orange, bring it back to Orange, trying to get teenagers to just go out and earn Bitcoin. You don't have to file paperwork with some person in some city that you don't live in to form a company to just start trading peer-to-peer with people with Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is just this thing on the internet that exists and no one can actually stop you from receiving it. I'm not trying to encourage people to break whatever laws are in their jurisdiction, but I do think that the more young people play with it and earn it and spend it and just create that economy all around the world, the incumbents will have to just catch up and start using it themselves. And even the incumbent way of funding public works in New Zealand, like taxation, that just has to innovate and adapt. The way El Salvador has done it's quite interesting. They've basically said you're welcome to earn Bitcoin from anywhere in the world and spend it anywhere in El Salvador. There's no tax implications whatsoever. Just go out and get the Bitcoin and spend it here and stimulate our economy. And the way that we will get a piece of that to help build the public infrastructure to help keep growing our economy is that for the physical places that you're shopping at, the physical stores that we, the local government with the guns, can actually go up and audit and check out what they're doing, will require them to do a transaction fee, like a GST or a sales tax. That actually means that the government is aligned with the growth of the economy. They want lots of transactions, lots of economic activity happening because they're getting a cut every time. And they can only enforce that really on physical premises, like the physical buildings. And actually, really, that makes sense because the physical buildings are the ones benefiting from the physical roading infrastructure that the government's building for them. Whereas a digital entrepreneur providing a digital service, you shouldn't really just have to voluntarily hand over cash to someone in your region for protection money. But you'll be spending all that money you're earning if you're doing well in that economy, and that's helping fund the security of that region. So, like, taxation is going to have to innovate with Bitcoin.
That's a really powerful idea, and I think, riffing on that a little bit, this analogy with file sharing, really, it disintermediated, these kind of physical discs and this kind of physical media into a digital media, and in a way, we're seeing the same thing here. Your Orange server, this game, it's purely virtual. There is no footprint to it, and it can get reset every month, or it can get turned off, or upgraded and scaled, and there's no physical footprint to that. And that's value existing in a dimension, like it's not even a physical dimension anymore. It's like in a different place. And so the brick and mortar government and the guns and batons kind of old school approach no longer applies when you've got this other virtual dimension
It's a
of,
whole new
yeah.
economy, a new layer of economy in the digital world up there in cyberspace or whatever, in the cloud. But I think that new economy and the potential of it is huge. But it doesn't replace the physical economy. It actually grows the physical economy. Because as we're all earning more money, creating more services, doing more things in the digital economy, we still need to buy food and we still need to upgrade our own quality of life in the real world where we're actually physically based. And so it can really drive the economy in the physical world too.
Yeah, and I think that your what you described about the tax situation is also very interesting, because it historically has been quite a forceful relationship, but that hegemonic negotiation between the powers and the people, can be changed through technology. And so we're seeing that now, where if you're earning in this virtual space, it's actually there needs to be an opt-in, in terms of the tax obligation, what are you going to do, sort of thing. And that really is a powerful position, and it swings the pendulum back into the favor of the people. And especially when you look at I mean, how government money gets spent and how, I mean, again, the road to serfdom, Austrian economics, you know, the government is the worst allocator of capital. And so you think, well, actually, I don't agree with the way they're spending money. I would like to see an audit on the way they're, you know, procuring these projects and managing things. You don't really have the option to opt out of that system currently. You know, you're basically, you know, by threat of imprisonment or fine, forced to kind of comply. And because there's no mechanism for that to self-correct, it's just going to do what it does. But actually, if the governments of the world have to kind of get on board and say, well, look, we really, you know, would like, you know, the meat space that you live in to be as best as possible. You know, here's our proposal. What do you think? And it becomes a lot more of a of an agreement and a compromise type situation as opposed to an all-encompassing a money grab.
Yeah, it's hard because the government is individuals, they're people too. The ones who get into power is due to popularity, which is fine because you want someone who cares about their public perception so that they don't, you know, they want to, if someone cares about their popularity, it's because they're listening to all the feedback. They're listening to all the comments out there and they don't want to be unliked. They want to be loved. That's why money is spent so poorly as well. It's because the loudest complaints can sometimes not have the best solution. So people who are upset and grieving about their current situation, and they fall back to the idea of, well, the state, the government should do something to fix it. That could be correct. There could be an opportunity for the government to help. But their call to action is usually, well, here's our proposal. We want the government to spend money on XYZ. And because their complaint and their grievance is legitimate and they want help, the government doesn't have necessarily the original ideas themselves. They listen to the complaints and they listen to their suggested way of spending money to solve it. And they do that to maintain their popularity. And so that's how most governments eventually become unpopular, because they are listening to their base a bit too much and doing policies that aren't necessarily well thought through. And then you just have a change of government who is hopefully listening to the opposition, which is always growing. So it's always like, in New Zealand, it's quite interesting that we do kind of always switch between the two kind of sides, but we usually have coalitions. We usually don't have one-party governments. And that was, when you have a one-party government, you're really able to push through whatever it is you want to do without much challenge or pushback. Which is interesting because that can be used for really good things where you don't have to get general consensus. You can actually just do what's logical and makes rational sense. And then people after the fact will see from the results that it worked. I think an example of that is Nayib Bukele in El Salvador. He got overwhelming popularity. He's like 90% popularity. So he, and then when they re-elected their version of parliament, he got such a majority that now he can push through any laws he wants. Some people criticize that and call it a dictatorship, but actually the reality is he's a popular politician that's able to now do what he wants based on what his team thinks is right, doesn't have to get the buy-in of everyone. And so it's interesting where it's hard to know whether coalitions or one-party governments are the most effective way to really grow an economy, and it's hard to know who are they listening to or who they're getting their advice from. And so at the end of the day, I guess I'm trying to get to, it's a long-winded way of saying this, is that it's the individuals that have to call the shots that can make mistakes, no matter how well-intentioned all these people are. They can all make mistakes. And they are trying to be popular. They're listening to other people's advice. And so what I like about Orange is the state or the administration isn't trying to make rules for people. It's trying to not have rules so that people can have complete permission, that complete freedom to actually be innovative. And that's the key crux I'm getting to, is that instead of lobbying the state to actively make rules to benefit Bitcoin, it's almost like I just want the state to ignore Bitcoin and let it flourish and not create rules. Because when they create rules, they're creating a regulatory capture for the people who benefit from those rules.
Yeah, just developing that a little bit further. Are you familiar with the book, The Network State? by Balaji. So the network state, how to starting a country. Are you familiar with that?
I haven't read it, but someone recommended it to me literally 2 days ago in Orange, because I was talking about Orange and the state, and they're like, this is a network state. It's a network state. I was like, okay, I'll have to go read that.
So here's an idea for you. I think broadly, and what I'm interested in exploring with this podcast, larger transformations that are taking place. So obviously Bitcoin, there's an economic transformation, but also, I mean, quite clearly we're entering a new era of politics, of disinformation, of post-truth. You know, I mean, we've seen the postmodern era, but now we're in the post-truth era where nothing even makes sense. And some people call it clown world, but really you flick on the TV, you know, what is that? And it literally doesn't make sense. And so, you know, rationality, logic breaks down in the face of that. And arguably politics kind of falls into that same thing where it's like, you know, who are these people? They're just sound bites and Twitter, you know, 6 second sort of clips. There's no substance to it. And I wonder if we can bring this back to Bitcoin and we think, okay, well, what is the base layer? Okay, so the politicians, that, you know, these, you know, brick and mortar, you know, these physical buildings don't have presence in the virtual space. They try to, but they really can't do it. And so they have jurisdiction over meat space. But by being so all-encompassing and trying to micromanage everyone's lives, they've kind of bloated the base chain of government. And so think of it, it's like they're the Ethereum of a political ideology, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if we were to run the Bitcoin scenario, so what would a Bitcoin government look like? You know, I think there's right now a really powerful discourse happening, you know, around the world, you know, about the different kind of options. We've now got optionality around talking about what government could be. And there's obviously, you know, monarchists, anarchists, all these different kinds of labels. But I think if you were to really boil it down, what are the key functions in, with Bitcoin? You know, you've got 21 million, you've got the halvenings, you've got these kind of key mechanisms that are unchangeable aspects. What are the unchangeable kind of minimum requirements for government in things like freedom, you know, private property, these kinds of, you know, these kinds of ideas?
Everything, or does Bitcoin achieve all that?
Yeah.
Like,
and then abstract everything else out. Don't the government, you know, you're trying to tell me how, you know, what I can and can't do with my business on the base layer. You know, don't do that. Leave that to layer two. Right, which, and if you follow the network state, you know, and these kind of ideas that you're exploring with Orange, I mean, it's all going to be in the cloud. We're going to have factories and you know, manufacturing happening in the real world, but the actual innovation and ideas and IP are going to be generated digitally. And so let that be. You know, there's no role for government in that virtual space.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, right? Like the network state. Yeah, I think that government, like you said, like what is it that they should be setting the parameters or framework or structure? What topics, what areas should they be covering? And like the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that we realize that it's assets, it's wealth, it's money that needs to be at the base layer, fair. It needs to be the ultimate fair thing that can't be gamed by anyone, can't be corrupted or captured or controlled by anyone or influenced by anyone individually. And so now that we've distributed and decentralized the money, as you said, everything else is like a layer two on top. And so government, it's like I live in an apartment building. So I understand the need for having someone to actually do the work. Like there is maintenance required on the building. How do we coordinate for that to happen? Well, all the tenants pitch in money to what's called a body corporate here in New Zealand. And that's an entity that's owned by the owners of the building and run by the owners of the building, but it's still a committee that you've just delegated the responsibility for the day-to-day decisions of, you know, which plumber to hire if there's a leak in the common area of the building, or which company to hire to clean the windows. Not every individual in the apartment building wants to be involved in that decision. So scaling that up to a whole country, there is still like a need to have someone making some of these decisions on behalf of us, and we're all just pitching in money for them to do it. But the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that when the money itself is decentralized and distributed and can't be corrupted, you don't have to trust those people that much because you could always move. And that makes government more local. So if you don't like the decisions being made in your city, you can move to another city. If you don't And you can do that between countries, although during the COVID era, the war that the world is in right now, it appears in our mind like we can't, but you absolutely can get up and leave your country. All the governments in every country in the world right now have mass advertising slash propaganda encouraging people not to leave because they are all conscious that we are free individuals and we can leave. So yeah, like governments, they also want to motivate us to actually be productive citizens and help build this country. And they don't necessarily have the best ideas for that, but one of the best ideas ever is for them to stop being involved in a system that creates unfairness. Like it is the money being a bit corrupt or unfair that demotivates so many people and stops them from putting in the effort to try build wealth.
So on that note, so a couple of things there. So yeah, localism, city states, smaller locations, being independent of each other, something really powerful about that. Only possible on hard money, really, though, because the New Zealand dollar, effectively, a couple of islands here in the South Pacific, in a global, we don't have a say that there is a global fiat system and we're part of that. However, on say the gold standard back in the day, or on a Bitcoin standard, gold is gold no matter who you are and or how big or how small you are. And so, you can have pretty much the MVP, which is maybe towns or cities or even smaller, can fully function, and their money is just as good as anyone else's because they're on the same standard.
If they grow too quickly and grow their wealth too fast, and the rest of the world sees it, because it's real wealth, it's real gold, or it's real Bitcoin in the current example, there's still an increasing security risk because there is always people in the world that want to steal from others. And so that is where, while the local government and the cities are kind of the way of the future in terms of regulation and behavior and how people should behave, it's up to their local government. Because when it's local, you have more influence over it, you can change it much quicker. But there is still that overarching idea of, well, the defense of the whole nation.
Defense, yeah.
And in our case, we have to use politics, international politics, to help defend our nation because we don't necessarily have the gunpowder or the manpower to defend it. And so that does create that kind of. It's hard for me to imagine there not being that global big governments that still exist, like the big empires. Like there's still defense contractors that are competing with each other to defend these regions. But I guess you could say if the world was at peace, you wouldn't need to have security. But the moment everyone stops thinking about their security is right when they're at risk the most from someone who is thinking about attacking. Like you never know what people are planning.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think so. Firstly, like a meta topic that to that would be, these are really important discussions, and these are for the first time they're actually something that can be actuated, actualized in the real world. And so that it's a muscle that we haven't exercised for a long time outside of writing science fiction or something. So there's a really important role for these kind of discussions around what the thing could be, but more specifically to the defense point. I guess there's two potential threat models. One is the Americans or the Russians, coming in and trying to take it. The other one would be these kind of marauding, non-nation state aligned groups, both of which are problematic. However, coming back to Bitcoin, unlike gold, it's very difficult to confiscate. And so, you've got your 12 words, you've got your multi-sig. It's not going to get taken, and they have to kill you. And even then, maybe you don't even have the ability to give them the keys, because
But
it's multi-sig,
I think an example that has always been with me throughout my Bitcoin journey, because this person is a similar age to me and has similar interests to me, an example of how you can still be deprived of your freedom is like Ross Ulbricht with the Silk Road. Like he made a website. He wasn't the one dealing in things on the website. He just let people trade with each other. And what did they end up trading? Well, the items that are really difficult to obtain in your country. So in New Zealand, cannabis is illegal, but it's used a lot for medicinal purposes. So one of the main ways to get it in New Zealand is to use one of those online free markets or darknet markets like the Silk Road. And there are so many of them now. So he started something that is real, that's continued to exist. But because he started it, and because he started it in a country that isn't very free at all, has the highest incarceration rate in the world, the US. He has spent 10 years of his life now deprived of his freedoms, and he has another double life sentence ahead of him. So they permanently locked him away. Now, that doesn't really, having a government to protect you from enemy governments and their armies is good, but it's also, you need to be protected from your own government. And his wealth, his Bitcoin, is still protected. They can't confiscate that from him, but they can make an example out of someone if they wanted to. And so,
Yeah, well, that's sort of a, I guess, a third model for for the threat there. But I guess, who's the big bad wolf? Who's going to come? Like, if it's not the government, is it some kind of, is it, I think 1984, is it Eurasia? Like, who's coming to take my Bitcoin? I don't know, man. Like, in a Bitcoin world, like, is that even feasible? I mean, this is the utopianism coming through, but, can they actually take it, or can they only just try and destroy the base layer, and lock themselves off from actually trading with you?
Yeah, they can't. That's what's great about Bitcoin, right? The security. So bringing it to Orange is that you build your home in Orange, right? You get all your little assets, you go get your guns, you get all this cool loot, you build up this big base, and then what happens is someone comes along with rocket launchers and blows their way into it and steals all your stuff. The lesson people are learning very quickly is, oh, well, if I had sold my stuff for Bitcoin or converted it into Bitcoin, if I had gone out and earned that blood and traded that in for Bitcoin and withdrawn the Bitcoin to my own custody, it doesn't matter when I log back on and find that my base has been destroyed, because the raiders didn't actually get the valuable thing, which was my savings. So the wealth that you're accruing in your base that's spread across various items, like let's say in this game, something that's quite valuable is a really good quality gun, because they're quite hard to make and they're quite hard to find, but they're really useful if you want to go out and do fun things with them. There's no point having 10 AK-47s, for example. Why not sell the extra ones you don't need to other people? And then you could get the Bitcoin, withdraw it, and then you're not as upset when you get raided. And that's what kids like these 15, 16-year-olds are learning quite quickly, is like Bitcoin, even within this simulated game environment, Bitcoin is providing them with that idea of saving, like that checkpoint, saving their progress. So it's not such a big deal when they get wiped out and they feel like they've lost everything, because actually they didn't. The progress they made, they were able to then convert that into Bitcoin and save it.
Yeah, I like the idea of the checkpoint and the save point. You
Yeah,
kind of.
that's bringing it back to this question about the state and the government and motivating the population. The reason the population is so demotivated is because everyone is aware that they were scammed by the fiat currency. But this it's not really a scam. It's to be expected when a company like a startup is struggling. They issue more equity and dilute existing equity holders. That's what the government does. When the government is struggling because it's spent money poorly and no one's willing to lend it any more money, it borrows money from itself, i.e., it prints money. But what that has the effect of is diluting the value of every dollar. So it's like diluting the equity in a startup. And the people who got burned were anyone who had saved up dollars in New Zealand, Kiwi dollars, anyone who had saved them. It's effectively the same as if the government came to everyone's bank account and took 20% of the money and removed it. But because that's so politically unpopular, the easier way is just to dilute the value of the money by printing more of it and lending it to themselves. And we can argue all day about whether it was actually needed, because COVID, while being extremely serious and, had to be dealt with somehow, did the government, the it had to fund a lot of things because it was the one locking down the economy. It wasn't COVID that locked down the economy. So that's where, a lot of debate could happen.
Well, that's quite recent, but I mean, the reality is there's always been inflation. So even
There's always a reason to print money.
there's always been a reason, man, and it didn't really matter. They'll come up with one. And so you're right, the whiskey's getting watered down, and everyone's money's losing purchasing power. But because it's just that little bit more abstracted away, I mean, I still get them taking 20% of the money out of my bank account, but that's tax. But the other tax of inflation, which is more pernicious, is unseen, and unless you're looking carefully and sort of like really staring at it, you don't see it happen, because it happens slower. It's over these periods of months and years, as opposed to one day, you know, it's just gone. It's the, yeah.
And the government, the state, has responded to the public's feedback about inflation. They have to be transparent about it. Like they, the government, the what we have built the government over decades to be what it is today. And the CPI is a measure of inflation. Now, obviously that can be a little bit manipulated, but in general, the idea is that, okay, sure, we're devaluing the money, but to keep everything fair, what about if we peg your salary increases every year to the inflation rate, so you actually get an increase in salary, so you're still even? That's good in principle, that idea of, oh yeah, that makes sense. But why should we do it that way? Because that is so bad, because so many people do not get raises in line with inflation, or they get the raise, but it's a year after the dilution events happened. So everything is already 20% more expensive, and that raise takes them a whole nother year to earn that salary increase. Basically, it's like we've got this really complex system with all these really complex things to try and make it fairer, but it would just be so much fairer if people just understood that. Well, this is also where the central bank does try to communicate this sometimes, is that New Zealand dollars are not for saving. Well, fiat currency, US dollars, all fiat currencies are not an instrument that can be used for saving. The people telling you it can are the private companies, the banking cartel, and they're giving you interest rates on your savings accounts, they call it, you know, a savings account. It is absolutely not a savings account. It is lending money to a private company at an interest rate that's always, pretty much in my lifetime, but I'm sure back in the day it might be different, but in my lifetime it's always been lower than the real inflation rate, so you're actually losing money. The government, so it's like the wrong tool for the job.
Yeah.
The fiat currency is a good tool for medium of exchange before we had Bitcoin. It was a useful tool. It helped create the global economy we have now and the digital economy that we do have now. But it's not a useful tool for helping people build wealth and save wealth. And the average person doesn't actually want to have to even think about how to do that, because every time they do think about it, they get scammed. They go and invest in some company that steals their money, or they go invest in some property that ends up not appreciating in value like they thought it would. And so they, some people just fall back to just saving the cash in the bank, which is where they're then getting a little bit kind of robbed on the side.
A little bit, yeah, quite a lot, yeah.
But that's where Bitcoin, like, complements fiat currency, because Bitcoin is a different tool for a different job. It's savings.
Yeah.
But it's also a medium of exchange, so it disrupts the medium of exchange part of the fiat currency too.
I think what's powerful is that it gives a place where you can stand from which to observe the existing system. And I remember vaguely, the 2008 crisis and all of that, and New Zealand was a little bit insulated compared to the US, but still, you know, it was something, you know, we learned about, and you sort of saw it around you. And I remember, you know, interest rates roughly at that time were a lot higher, maybe 6-8% in the bank. But it seems like ever since then, and that was the genesis period of Bitcoin, ever since then it's gone into this ridiculous territory where, again, clown world, you know, interest rate money in the bank, good as gold. None of this stuff, Matt. You know, these phrases even that we use. You know, gold price has been suppressed for decades. Like,
well, the interest rate at the bank has over time gotten lower, generally, because the banks over time have become part of the state. They've worked through the regulation, guarantees, insurance on all their deposits. They've managed to turn it into what you could call in finance a risk-free investment, say a deposit at the bank, because the government is ensuring that they'll give you back that money, but they're only insuring the nominal value, the fiat value. They're not insuring the actual real value of that money. And so it's like interest rates have fallen, and the problem that the world was in before COVID, not the problem, but the reality was the economy, global economy, was slowing down, and interest rates were going actually negative in some parts of the world, because there was a lot of cash out there that wasn't circulating. It was just being stored. And the more demand there is to store it somewhere, the lower the interest rates are, because you can accept a lower and lower interest rate.
So are you saying the virus didn't come out of the lab in Wuhan? It came out of the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve?
I wasn't even thinking about COVID anymore. I was thinking about that was the The excuse to cut rates so low that it scared people into spending their money. And that happens every 10 years. And it's gonna like we're gonna have negative interest rates eventually on fiat currency. That's actually what happens the moment the CBDC comes out, which kind of already exists, but the moment it's more formalized, that process of having your fiat actually being cast. So in New Zealand, for example, it's like the US, the central bank and the major banks are kind of one entity effectively, kind of now, not really, but that money, your deposits, are going to be now basically with the central bank, if not already guaranteed by the government. When interest rates go negative, it's just another way of saying use it or lose it. It's like when an airline says, if you don't use your reward miles within a year, you're going to lose them. And the government wants to be able to have that ability because it wants to be able to turn on the taps of stimulating the economy when it wants to. And that's coming, that eventually happens. But one of the reasons it actually happens isn't just the central bank saying rates are now lower. It's the event that scares people into locking up their money with the government and buying those government bonds, which drives the interest rates down. And the event is, you're worried about your retirement. Well, the world's turning to shit. You better lend your money to the government now, and everyone piles into government bonds. Or you're worried about earning a return on investment over the next 3 years when we're telling you that the world's going to be completely stagnant because we're locking it all down because there's a virus or whatever it is. Well, people rush to lend their money to the government, and that does drive interest rates down.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. I'm signed up to the Reserve Bank of New Zealand's newsletter just to keep abreast of the shenanigans. And I got a little update here around deposit takers legislation and how that's been modernized. I think New Zealand was lagging compared to other countries around sort of insuring people's money in the bank. And this, I think, yeah, here we go.
200,000, I think, or 100,000, or something like that.
100,000, yeah. So in the
Yeah.
event a deposit taker fails, they'll be eligible for up to 100 grand per depositor per institution.
So that is effectively like in the US when a couple of the banks went under recently, they kind of fast tracked that idea of guaranteeing not all deposits, but they did this thing where the banks, they take your money and then they go and invest it in bonds. It's into the government bonds, for example. And those are meant to be marked to market. They're meant to reflect that as interest rates rise from 2% to 6%, if you locked up your money at 2%, but now the interest rate is 6%, if you want to get your money out of that bond, you actually have to accept less than what you put into it. If you put $100 into it, you can't get your, if you have, you can get your $100 back if you wait until the end of the period. Let's say it's a 10-year bond. If you wait 10 years, you get the $100 back. But because interest rates have gone up so much, all the new bonds being issued have like a 6-7, like these huge interest rate coupons on them. If you want your money out today, because you need cash today, you have to let the next investor have a similar rate of return as what's available in the market. So you have to sell it for less than $100. So they're paying less than 100 for it. And that extra that they make at the end of the period effectively gives them that equivalent interest rate to what the current new bonds are. So what I'm trying to get at is what they did in the US was, you can get basically, I think it was par, you can get $100 for every $100 you have in a bond, no matter what its actual market value is. You can get that $100 cash right now by just giving it back to the government or pledging it in part of a repo deal or something. Yeah, so I sometimes describe what's happening with the banking. I call them a cartel just to be cheeky, but with the banking institutions, it's effectively nationalization. It's like the post office. All being consolidated into one post office and being part of the government. Fiat banking is all being consolidated into the government, and the CBDC kind of formalizes that. But when I say banking, I mean the act of holding New Zealand dollars as a deposit and just using it as a medium of exchange. That's kind of been nationalized. But banking itself is a whole bunch of other products and services around that, and that's not being nationalized. So when you go to spend your dollars and you want to invest it, the brokerage is competitive amongst the banks. It's very competitive, actually, the brokerage.
So there's sort of a privilege there to be in that gilded group who can actually hold the NZD.
Yeah, well, exactly. But that could be what the CBDC disrupts. The probably most controversial opinion I have in Bitcoin that will get me cancelled is I'm not as afraid of a CBDC as everyone else is. I guess it's because we're from a small country where our CBDC is quite local to us. I am afraid of a one world global US dollar CBDC because that's the ultimate surveillance state control, how you can spend fiat. But if you think about it for New Zealand, it's basically just saying that brokerage issue we brought up earlier of how to buy Bitcoin. Well, we've got to go through those gatekeepers who currently are the CBDC, that banking group, which is actually 80% Australian owned. The four major banks, Australian, and then the fifth bank's New Zealand. Once there's a CBDC, it's a digital token. It's actually US dollar tether. Once we have a New Zealand dollar tether, once we have that, New Zealanders will benefit massively with their existing New Zealand dollars that they're earning. They can spend that more globally a lot easier, in my opinion. If we took New Zealand dollar, put it on the liquid network on Bitcoin and made New Zealand dollar tether, it would be super useful for me as a New Zealander earning New Zealand dollars, spending New Zealand dollars here. And then the criticism of CBDC is the ability to censor the payments. But when you view the world as Bitcoin exists, because it does exist and you can't get rid of Bitcoin, it's a different system that, because it can be censored, it will be censored. And that's because they're trying to do something different with it. So that's how they give out benefits in New Zealand, or unemployment benefit or injury benefits. If you are struggling to find work in New Zealand, the government will give you money each month or each week to help you get by. But they won't give you real money. They're not going to give you Bitcoin. They're going to give you their token, their CBDC. And they just want to ensure that while they're propping you up and helping you through that tough time, they just want to ensure that you only spend it on the necessities, food, and accommodation, right? They don't want you to go spend it at the liquor store, for example, because that's where a lot of New Zealand's money ends up.
So,
So it's like,
yeah, riffing on that though, that's actually a really good point because that's one of the criticisms of CBDCs is that, it's programmable. You could turn it off for certain things. But if you flip it and you run the scenario that we're living in the network state, we're living in cities, local government, there's also reward that can be paid out in hard money. So Bitcoin. So I'm living, I live in a place I really like. I want to contribute. I get paid for being part of that place because they've got Bitcoin holdings and they release that to people who've been citizens for a couple of years or whatever. So I get real money out if I'm productive in. Whereas if you're down on your luck, you've had some issues. I do think there is some benefit in having a system that helps support people who are vulnerable or have had issues that mean that they're not able to contribute straight away to the economy. But the way they get paid out isn't through hard money; it's through this token.
Exactly. It's like if you think of New Zealand like Disneyland, it's basically like if there was just a loyalty point slash token that you can only use within New Zealand, really, like it because it's created by New Zealand to redeem at New Zealand services by the government. And it does create that social credit system. That's what it is. It's a social credit system. But the idea is that people are less likely to take advantage of that social credit system when it is heavily restricted and can only be used for those necessities. And so that's probably what it will only be used for. But any individual in this world, even though we're in a walled garden of New Zealand or Disneyland, because we can never be stopped from saving our wealth in Bitcoin, we just see the fiat currency as a tool we can use to earn and accumulate wealth, but not by accumulating fiat currency. It's just the tool that we then use to buy Bitcoin, or we use to buy goods and services or merchandise that we sell for Bitcoin. And every time we move it into Bitcoin, we're actually saving it.
And just sort of riffing on that a bit more. I mean, this is new territory for me, but you'll be familiar with Gresham's law. Bad money drives out good, and there's this sort of game theory that the back in the day that you'd take the silver coins out of the cashier would,
Well, in this scenario, the CBDC that let's say can only be used on food, it's actually going to be the big supermarkets that the government regulates that'll be forced to accept it. But if I'm running a local butcher, I might just say, no, I don't want to accept that. I want Bitcoin. Or I'll encourage people to pay me in hard money by giving Bitcoin as a discount. But that's where the government steps in with its legal tender law, which forces everyone to accept their CBDC or their fiat currency.
So, well, sorry, I'm just wondering though, running that scenario out, Is there a situation where the game theory kind of, you know, I think, you know, the maximalist game theory is that, yeah, you know, Bitcoin is always going to win. It's the, you know, the silver coin's been taken out of the drawer. But in this case, could we see a renewed interest with localism being the other component here, where actually people are like, yeah, look, there is this other, you know, NZ, you know, the Wellington digital currency or whatever. Yeah.
It's kind of the meat space, cyberspace thing, yeah, where Bitcoin has absolutely already won the internet money race. It's the only one that's actually internet cash. So it's the only one that people are going to actually use on the internet in the long run. That's where the Gresham's law really is happening right now on the internet. It's driving out all the crypto. Like, why would I pay for a microservice of like computing power with Ethereum if it means I have to first buy the Ethereum with my Bitcoin and then spend the Ethereum to do it? Why not just accept Bitcoin directly? So all the internet services, the future economy, which is huge, much probably bigger than the physical economy, the digital economy.
Layer 2 digital economy.
Layer 2. Yeah. That's definitely like Bitcoin dominates, right? But in meat space, because of that issue of how do we pay for physical security, how do we pay for infrastructure, and how do we, you know, collaborate a bit in meat space, we have this state that we've already built over decades. How does it innovate and adapt to this digital world? Well, it can focus on what its strengths are, which are also its weaknesses of why it fails in the digital world. But its strength is that it can have this currency that it can control. And so it can become what it already is, which is that unit that people use and think about here. But it's not, it's not what people are going out to try and really earn and save. It's just like it becomes more of an actual statistical measurement unit, which is what it is trying to be, where you don't, you know, when probably when you're a kid as well, you thought $1 million home was, you know, a mansion.
Yeah.
In New Zealand, for the listeners, $1 million home is no longer a mansion.
It's any it's the average house price is $1 million, man. Like,
yeah, so like kids get kind of scammed. It's like Santa Claus. They get told, yeah, one day you'll be a millionaire. Well, once they start thinking in terms of sats and Bitcoin, and they're striving for something that's actually a real metric, a real standard of measurement that doesn't change over the years, they can actually start to strive for the right goal. When you're just striving for quantity of fiat, when you just want to have $1 million, well, by the time you get it, it's not worth what you thought it was anyway.
Yeah.
And so
I wonder if there's something here as well. You know, you and I are of this generation. I mean, I'm assuming you remember 2008 vaguely from your younger years, but we're of a generation who grew up through that, but weren't old enough necessarily to really be, you know, sort of more of our parents' problem, you know. And I'm wondering if you're with Orange and with some of these kind of emerging trends we're seeing with like Gen Z and this kind of reaction to work and kind of a search for meaning post-COVID, that we're going to see a huge generational shift happen, you know, an avalanche of young people coming out who are just like, yeah, like what's a bank? You know, just like you and I might be like, well, what is a TV? Yeah. You know, what is the radio? You know, you want to listen to the radio? Like,
oh, you mean cigarettes aren't good for me? I think that was our generation's one, was like, it's appalling when we look back and see the advertising that claimed to be medical advice, saying that doctors recommend cigarettes, but it was all just fake advertising, really. And that's what's happening today with people saying that, like, putting your money in the bank and investing it in their KiwiSaver and all that stuff is all super safe and not risky.
Well, it seems really like matter out of place when you see young people, and like people I know who are like, yeah, man, like they've just got their first job and they're like, yeah, I'm on Sharesies. I'm like, bro, what are you doing? Like,
yeah. Well, I guess it's a necessary step, because if we accept that the fiat currency can't be used for savings, then what we're saying is people need to learn how to invest their money. Well, now we're understanding that actually we can just have better money, which is Bitcoin, that you can just hold and save, and you won't be required to go out and speculate it. But I can see why people who don't understand Bitcoin yet, to get away from the inflation and the failures of fiat as a savings tool, they go out and they invest it. And that's what I did. That's what I was excited about when I got into university too. And that's actually like still a thing that we need, is we need the money to be. So while Bitcoin is savings, we still need people to be spending their Bitcoin, because we do want the economy to actually grow, and we want things that should be built, and money needs to be spent for things to be built. But the nature in which that they're coordinating to do it, the token, the equity, the security that they're using, the state has tried very hard to make that fair and regulated, where those companies have to disclose everything they're doing. But that still is ripe with fraud and lots of failures. Most companies fail. And that's what the crypto token economy was as well. It was basically a completely unregulated version of that. And we saw just how disastrous capital allocation was when there were no requirements that the people raising capital had to actually be accountable for what they're spending the money on. So it's like we're still going to have that with like security tokens, but they're going to be done in ways that are more transparent, like the ones that are on Liquid are quite interesting. But that is a trusted investment, right? That's trusting someone. Any security token is trust. That's why it's called a security, and that's why it's regulated. But the mindset of people should be that's your spending money. You're spending money when you invest it in a company, but you're not saving money. You're saving money when you store it as Bitcoin.
And I think that that's what I was getting at. Obviously, I mean, young people were, I mean, they have no choice. They have to find a way to save, so to speak. And that in this case has become, Sharesies or these kind of, easy stock, apps that you can just buy and mess around.
Yeah, like Robin Hood in the US.
And that this is a phenomenon where people aren't necessarily aware of the reason why they have to do that. But that's the only real, use case that's open to them, because maybe they're too young to be able to buy a house. So it's like, where else are you going to put your money? And so there's this kind of degenerative effect where it actually creates speculation on ETFs and things that don't really have productive value, and the actual ability for someone to understand a company deeply and invest in that, I mean, that's not really rewarded anymore.
It's a full-time job.
And so in a way I'm wondering whether Orange, and I'm wondering, if there's similar projects out there that are operating maybe in different areas of that kind of emerging trend towards younger people, Gen Z, who are coming up into this brave new world post-COVID, and so you and I post 2008, and we had it good for a little while, but it still kind of sucked. But these kids, they really have nothing. And you're seeing that, places like China, the work culture. I was watching a video on that, like 9-9-6, 9 till 9, 6 days a week. These emerging kind of effects of inflation, of shrinkflation, of just, the end game, I guess, of fiat are coming out, and people are just sort of saying, no, I don't want that anymore. The allure of the hustle and I'm going to make it is kind of worn off, and people are like, man, I just want to take it easy.
Well, I mean, that's probably concerning for the government, who's the people lobbying them are the businesses that need human labor to function, and productive human labor. I think New Zealand's been pretty good at trying to set a scene where companies, workers have rights, obviously, but also companies are trying to innovate on how to make people more productive without necessarily making them work like a dog, like a slave. With the whole, a lot of companies in New Zealand are now trialing the 4-day work week, like things like that, or really happy to support remote work. Like the future post-COVID is actually very bright for workers' rights. And young people have also learned that you don't have to hitch your whole career and your whole livelihood on one company. It's actually naive and almost foolish of you to have assumed that. And that's probably an error with the education system and university, trying to tell people that you have to get a graduate job and then work your way up at that firm, and that's going to pay for your retirement. Young people now realize that they have to focus on their skill set and improving themselves and their marketability and their ability to work for multiple employers. That's a huge change from when we were younger. And that's what a lot of people are doing now, is that the longer you can remain independent and contract to multiple employers and continue to upskill yourself, the more value you can really accrue. And then now with Bitcoin, the beautiful thing is you don't have to find an income that will provide for you for the next 50 years of your life or whatever. You don't have to try and find an employer that you think is going to be around 50 years and a stable job that's not going to get disrupted. You just have to focus on being really productive yourself while you're young and able to be productive, and just accumulate the wealth that you're earning, and actually just making sure you're saving it, like not spending it all. Definitely spend some on what you like, but also save some. And then with Bitcoin, that's the beautiful thing, is that you actually have that that real nest egg, not that fake nest egg of the government pension bullshit that by the time you earn it, it's not worth anything anyway. It's like this nest egg of Bitcoin is wealth, and there'll be a point when you stop accumulating it and you start thinking about the life you have left and how you can spend it to pay for the rest of your life without relying on other people, without relying on a state to take care of you. You took care of yourself by working really hard when you're young, and Bitcoin took care of you by actually saving that money for you. You didn't have it all rug pulled from you once you retired. Like the COVID crash in the market, right, is actually devastating for boomers. Many boomers now entering retirement, leading up to retirement, and everything rallied and they thought, sweet, my home, $1 million home, sweet, I've got my stocks, they're all up 20%. Well, at the moment they're not, and at the moment most boomers are heading into retirement, and that's that age group, that population that we have in New Zealand, that distribution. We've got that huge boomer population, what's around the world generally, that's now a burden for the state to fund that pension,
yeah,
to pay for people who weren't able to build their own retirement.
Yeah, and I think along those lines as well, just exploring my time in Japan, one thing that really stood out to me is just, I mean, they had quite a serious stock market crash in 1989, which sort of led to this, you know, lost generation, they call it, which sort of fully encompassed me and all of my friends. And so the people who are enjoying life, in a, you know, quote unquote, are all older people. And so one thing that I enjoy about New Zealand is, you know, you can be 25 and you can go scuba diving, you can, you know, go mountain climbing, you know, you can have a sport, you can have a hobby, maybe have a nice car. Like, it's still very accessible here. Whereas in Japan, anyone who's doing any of those nice things is at least 50. And it's because that whole generation from 89 through to today got wiped out and working away in a deflationary, shrinkflation type environment where houses and everything is getting more and more shit. And, you know, your wages are just kind of stagnant. And I wonder if this future you just described leads to almost a change in society where it's like young people, they work hard and then they're able to actually chill out a little bit. There leads to more of a, like a, you know, and, you know, invest in the arts and culture and kind of more of the soft aspects of a society. And
that's cool.
And not everyone is just an Uber Eats delivery guy slaving away, yeah, to pay his rent in an old house, you know, like, which is sort of this other situation, you know, kind of future vision of, you know, you'll be in the pod and you eat the bugs and, you know, this kind of meme at this point. But so I don't want that. I want to be able to, you know, take it easy and, you know, yeah, you work hard and you do your time, but then why aren't we reaping the rewards of technology and advancing and, yeah, and the accumulation of savings?
I think related to that, you mentioned like the generation when the huge stock market crash happened in Japan and the other ones have happened around the world since, and how that can take, especially in Japan, take a very long time to, if you were fully invested then, for those investments to get back to their high watermark, right? The thing about Bitcoin is that it absolutely has huge crashes. It has 80% crashes every 4 years, but it's only ever taken every 4 years to get back to its high watermark again. It's actually a cycle, and it's exactly like you say, like, when Bitcoin is bubbly, the people who have already been working really hard during the bear market, stacking sats and being productive, their savings has now got much more purchasing power. And so it becomes cyclical where during the bull market, they're spending more Bitcoin and stimulating the whole global economy. And during the bear market, they're more biased towards trying to earn Bitcoin and being productive. But everyone's at different stages. The early Bitcoiners have gone through many cycles. And while they still might reduce their spending in a bear market, they generally have Bitcoin to spend. Whereas new people who just got involved in 2021, they'll be feeling right now disheartened because they've just lost 80% of their savings. But if they have the right mindset of Bitcoin's a long-term savings thing, now they're being really productive and they're all getting to work and they're all trying to stack sats. And then it's not that they retire every 4 years, it's more that their spending habits will increase every 4 years.
Yeah, I was going to say that's, you've got me thinking here, like this really is a thing, because you've got obviously the boom bust cycle and how that has been hijacked and manipulated through the fiat system to basically wipe everyone out who's you know, on the lower end, and then, you know, reaccumulate at the top end. But almost in a way that this fixes that, because yeah, you're in the bear market, you know that you need, you know, stack as many sats as you can, son, build a business, be productive, learn some skills. You've got a 4-year window to do that. And it's not a 10-year cycle. It's not a generational cycle. It's 4 years. It's a very achievable 1,200 days to get yourself sorted. And then, you know, the next cycle comes in the next bull run or whatever. And you can, you know, if you wanted to, you could spend that, or you could opt to skip it and wait for another 4 years.
Exactly.
And
yeah, depending on your age, right? So if you're a young person, you probably could spend a decade working hard trying to stack your sats. But if you've already gotten older and already spent that decade stacking your sats, it might just be that you spend more in the bull market years and you spend less in the bear market years. And that's really, this is happening on a global scale right now. And the reason the global economy feels so depressing is because no one is spending money right now. Not many people are, really. Everyone's got their mindset of they need to save, partly because we all see the cheap assets out there that we're trying to save, like Bitcoin, but also because we're being told, you know, not to go out and take a risk and not to go out and build something because you need to tighten your belt and pay off the money you already owe if you have someone with a mortgage, for example. And that's quite depressing. And it's like, it's cyclical because it goes the other way too. In the bull market, spending is so loose. People are so bad with their money that ridiculous assets, ridiculous investments somehow raise the most money. They've got the best advertising, basically, the best marketing. That's what the entire kind of crypto security space really was just really good advertising. And every bull market, even experienced people are going to get attracted to a bad investment, which is unfortunate.
Well, I think that may change, though. I mean, we're seeing some of the SEC regulation in there, which is coming downstream. And, you know, unregulated securities, they always were. And maybe that's the end of them, at least from a regulatory perspective.
Certainly an end of the brazen advertising of them by, like, celebrity endorsements and how easily that, like, with Orange, I'm speaking to teenagers almost every day, and they don't, when you're young, you don't actually have the mental capacity to really verify everything, right? You're still learning the basics of life. What they can do is see a really friendly, familiar face on Instagram or Twitter on a tweet saying something positive about something, and they trust that. You know, everyone has to learn don't trust, verify. But young people, most people abstract that to, well, I'll just trust the people that I think that other people trust, the popular people. And that's where the lack of regulation around crypto securities really burnt a lot of people. And the people who promoted them should have known better. But at the same time, it's like humans are humans, right? You pay them to say something, they'll say something.
Yeah. Well, look, man, this has been very interesting. Thank you. It's been great to learn about Orange and your work with that project. If people want to follow you, find out more about Orange, or they want to join in and join the world, like how can they check in?
Yeah, so Orange Mart's website is Orange Mart, orangem.art. So it's Orange Mart with a dot between the M and the art, or at the Orange Mart on Twitter. I'm at James Vigie. And yeah, just if you're interested in, or if you're like, interested in esports, that's kind of the direction we're going with this. If you're interested in competition, but also interested in learning more about Bitcoin in a fun environment, that's really what it's all about. Like, we've got people who thought they knew about Bitcoin, but they hadn't even used the Lightning Network yet, right? Even though it's been around for so long. So this is a really fun way to play with the Lightning Network, and you feel like more comfortable playing with it when you didn't go out and buy the Bitcoin yourself. You actually earned it just from playing the game, and then you're more likely to then spend it and actually get experience with it. So if you want to get experience with Bitcoin, come check it out.
Yeah, it's a really cool project, and it reminds me of the broader concept towards value for value, which you'll be familiar with, things like Fountain or Wavelake and these different places where you can stream music or you can do a podcast and people can stream value over the Lightning Network. I'm just trying to think back to my young days playing Counter-Strike, and if I got some sats every time I got a headshot or whatever, or you get penalized if you're camping. I don't know, man. I can see, just like, as you said, BitTorrent, in the same way, it's a grassroots movement, bottom up. It's going to bring change. And maybe these kids who are playing this game right now are the ones who are going to be coming into the productive workforce in the coming years, and this will be all they know. And they'll look at a bank and they'll think, what is this scam?
And they're going to bring all the new technology to help us Bitcoiners. Like, sometimes Bitcoiners think that they know everything, but really these young people who are
pretty smart.
More exposed.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're smart, and they're using all these tools every day, like especially with the new stuff with AI. Like, they're going to have good ideas to help Bitcoin too.
Yeah, sweet, man. All right, James, I much appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, awesome. Catch sweet. You later.
See you, man. Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Ellingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.